Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Lauren Chulgen, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Well, today was supposed to be payday for hundreds of thousands of federal employees, but instead, the government shutdown continues. And the president is moving closer to declaring a national emergency to fund the border wall.
I have the absolute right to declare a national emergency. The lawyers have so advised me. I'm not prepared to do that yet, but if I have to, I will. I have no doubt about it. I will.
Well, no doubt about it. We're going to dig into how New Hampshire lawmakers and residents are feeling and talking about all this a bit later on. But first, it wasn't all politics news in New Hampshire this week, believe it or not. Conversations are continuing about how safe our drinking water is and whether wind turbines could be popping up on the seacoast. What environmental or energy concerns do you want New Hampshire to tackle next year, or this year rather? Give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. We're also broadcasting a live video of this radio broadcast, which you can watch at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And so, here to catch us up to speed on all things environment, energy, and then some is NHPR's Annie Ropeek. Hey, Annie. So let's do it. Let's actually, before we dig into what happened this week, I'd be curious to hear your forecast, so to speak, of what you think are going to be the biggest environmental or energy stories in New Hampshire this year.
Yeah, so we're gearing up for lots of renewable energy battles at the State House this year with the Democratic majority and Governor Sununu having expressed some concerns about some of their ideas, especially on things like solar power and that large-scale development, that kind of thing. Northern Pass should go before the state Supreme Court at some point this year, hopefully.
Ongoing drama.
Yes, so we will be revisiting that story. And then the drinking water thing is really heating up. The governor says we're going to look at New Hampshire's high rates of childhood cancer and what may be causing those. A lot of new standards are coming down the pipeline.
Right, that was in his inauguration address, yeah.
Yeah. So that's going to continue to be a big topic of conversation, I think.
Okay, so you'll be busy.
Yeah.
As you always are. So let's go to the latest news now and stick with drinking water first. So last Friday, you reported that the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services came out with new proposals on limits for PFAS chemicals. Anytime Annie's in, we're talking about PFAS. So let's start there. Remind us what those chemicals are and what the new standards could be.
Yeah, so PFAS chemicals are these industrial chemicals that are very persistent in the human body. They were found for many years in all kinds of household and industrial products. I think of it as anything that resists something, so like water, stains, or grease, or heat,
okay.
Gore-Tex jackets, Teflon pans, stain-resistant carpets, things like that. So they've been phased out of American manufacturing for the most part, but they're still prevalent in all of our blood at some low level, and they have been linked to serious health problems like kidney and liver disease, potentially some cancers. The science is still kind of evolving, but some states, including New Hampshire, have started to try to tackle these kind of absent broader federal regulations on these chemicals, which are still sort of developing really slowly.
Mm-hmm.
New Hampshire decided at the behest of the legislature last year to come up with drinking water limits on four of the broad class of PFAS chemicals. So this includes ones you might be familiar with, like PFOA.
Okay.
So the limits that they came up with are the same as were in place before as groundwater standards,
okay,
and the same as federal advice, or lower, not as low as advocates wanted, and not as low as some studies suggest, depending on how you interpret their language, may be necessary to protect human health.
Yeah, before we get to the response, I'm curious to hear more about, you know, how they make those decisions. You say there's some studies involved, but how do they come to these decisions?
Yeah, so it's super, super complicated, especially for chemicals like these that, you know, are still sort of thought of as emerging contaminants. Like, the science is still not entirely settled. There's new research all the time. Some of the research contradicts other research, mm-hmm. you know, and these chemicals are so tricky. They all have slightly different health effects, slightly different levels. They stay in the body for slightly different amounts of time. It's not clear how they interact with each other. And it's not even, you know, entirely, there's no scientific consensus yet entirely on what they do. And they're maybe broad sort of things that we can all assume and agree on, but that's not enough to make regulations, right? You need like details and specifics and numbers. So the state's toxicologists and epidemiologists have looked at all of the studies on animals and sort of studies on humans who have been exposed to these chemicals about the health effects that they've seen, at what levels of exposure, and they've factored in a bunch of uncertainty, and they sort of come up with a number that says, you know, at this dose in the sort of standard amount of water that we all drink, mm-hmm. this will be a good limit to protect human health. And they actually felt like the number they came up with first was protective, and so they didn't need to adjust it up or down for, you know, avoiding healthcare costs mm-hmm. or the cost of complying for public water systems. They also didn't have the resources to come up with as much of that data as they'd want to. So they're hoping to continue working on that this year.
Well, and on top of all this, I feel like for normal non-science people, it's the concept of the thing is such a hard yeah. thing for people to wrap their minds around about, you know, how much of this chemical in my water or how much in my then that's also a really difficult concept, I feel like.
Yeah, we're working in parts per trillion here, which I believe it's something like a drop of ink in like a oil tanker, like an oil tanker truck. Mm-hmm. You know, we say a part per billion is like a drop of ink in a bathtub or a barrel. And you know, these are the kinds of comparisons that
even
we
make. That is like, what?
Yeah, or a swimming pool and, you know, all right. of these kinds of comparisons. But we're talking about infinitesimal amounts here, and they stay in your body for a long time. So they accumulate, which means that even if, you know, the amount that you were initially exposed to by chewing on your parents' stain-resistant carpet as a baby didn't cause damage, maybe the exposure in drinking water over time might rise to a level where years down the road you could see health effects that may or may not be tied to that exposure.
And so these latest suggestions or proposals, I mean, you've reported that some of the most prominent activists around the state are kind of pushing back on this. So explain why.
Yeah, so people were hoping these numbers would be a lot lower. They point to a study that came out from the Centers for Disease Control last year, which is still in draft form, that suggested that it could be necessary to protect human health to regulate these chemicals at limits about 10, 15 times lower than the EPA and many states have said is safe. Now, those CDC levels, you know, are screening levels for cleanups at Superfund sites. They aren't necessarily meant to be used as standards, but they do still suggest that a low, low, low level of these chemicals could have some risk associated with it. And yeah. So people were hoping to see much lower standards. I don't think they trust that the state, you know, used the strictest possible science, even though state regulators say that based on all of their research, and they looked at literally hundreds of studies, that these are the right number, that these are protective, you know, with no other factors considered. But I think people are concerned that the chemical industry and manufacturers, you know, submitted comments on these proposals, which the state says they didn't take into any more account than anything. But advocates are worried that that was a factor. And I talked to Mindy Mesmer, who's a former state legislator who now is a consultant on these issues. And here's what she had to say.
I think they factored in a lot of the concerns of the industry and, you know, people that were worried about, you know, having increased costs associated with treating the water rather than really looking at the true cost of these public health impacts.
And so the state has said that it will cost public water systems between around $2 million and $8 million up front to sample for PFAS and to implement the treatment systems that will be necessary to comply with these rules if they're approved. The state also says they didn't factor those costs into their level. They're just putting them out there. Mm-hmm. But still, this will be a big change for public water systems, even at the levels that the state has come up with.
Okay, so that'll certainly be ongoing this year for you to be watching. And in other big drinking water news this week, there was some arsenic news. Can you first just give us a sense of the problem here? Because I feel like, you know, we hear all the time about PFAS chemicals, but then arsenic less so. Is that the case?
Yeah, I mean, arsenic is one of these sort of like legacy contaminants that isn't quite so hot in science right now because the science is pretty settled on arsenic. I mean, everyone knows arsenic
right.
is poisonous. It's like the, you know, the comedic poison you would come up with in a joke, right? So we are in a part of the country that has a pretty big arsenic problem. It's in the bedrock and the groundwater that we happen to live on, just at higher levels than other parts of the country, just on its own. If you look at like northern New England, sort of us up into Maine. Mm-hmm. And we also are much more reliant on well water here than many other parts of the country. And so between those two things, a study out of Dartmouth recently has linked our high levels of arsenic in our groundwater to our high rate of bladder cancer, which at times has been the highest in the country.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, and that's the thing I just didn't even know. I mean, how well known is this problem?
I think some private well users probably completely know about it. I mean, mm-hmm. it's something that they thought about when they decided to go to well water. I think other people who may have like inherited well water in a house that they bought may not think about it. And, you know, important to note is that private well users don't have to comply with these state standards like the ones we're talking about. State standards are for public drinking water. Mm-hmm. So what comes out of the water treatment plant in your city, that kind of thing. I think some researchers hope that the new state standards might kind of wake some well users up who are not currently filtering or testing their water kind of aggressively enough. And the state does some public information campaigning around, make sure you test your well water. This is a potential problem. But, you know, more can always be done. And I think state regulations and science is starting to move in a direction that suggests that we're not regulating arsenic tightly enough, and so people may not be testing it at low enough levels.
Yeah, and so tell us what happened this week. What were those standards that we heard about?
Yeah, so the state legislature again asked the Department of Environmental Services last year to come up with a new number for their arsenic rule. People were worried that the default number from the Environmental Protection Agency, which is 10 parts per billion, is not protective enough. So the Department of Environmental Services worked with UNH, and they came up with a new number that they say is feasible to treat for and actually could literally save lives, which is 5 parts per billion. There's only one other state in the country that's gone to a standard like that, which is New Jersey. And the UNH study is super interesting. It puts numbers on sort of how much people are willing to pay to avoid potential cancer diagnoses and other health problems that could be associated with a higher level of arsenic. And it says if the state went to this lower level over the next 70 years, we would avoid literally dozens of cancer cases, lung and bladder cancer, and like 3 to 8 cancer deaths.
Okay, so if that is the case and it's that profound of a change, you know, why did it take until 2019 to make this change?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's something activists have talked about for a long time. Arsenic, like you said, is, you know, has taken a backseat to some of these sort of emerging industrial chemicals,
right,
and the scientific resources can be limited. And people, you know, the federal advice is always the default. And I think there's a growing sense among sort of chemical protection activists that the federal standards may not be fully protective. And it's something that states need to take the initiative to look into on their own, even though they probably don't have the resources. So now mm-hmm. we're seeing our state legislature trying to give them more of those resources and give them more direction on the kind of changes that they want to see. So it's a really slow process. But I think, you know, DES is taking the arsenic study they did with UNH is the kind of first of its kind. So they're hoping to apply that kind of collaboration and that method of investigation to other chemicals in the future.
If you have questions for Annie Ropeek, our resident energy, environment, all things expert,
all things reporter,
give us a call 1-800-892-6477 or send us an email exchange@nhpr. We're going over all the energy environment news that was this week and looking ahead to what else will be going on in 2019. So if you got questions on what you'd like to see the state tackle, give us a call 1-800-892-6477. Or again, our email is just exchange@nhpr.org. And you know, Annie, that was not all this week.
Mm-mm.
There's not just drinking water news this week. You also covered, I saw Monday, there was some news about offshore wind. Governor Sununu has requested that a federal task force looks into opportunities for offshore wind. And so the questions that I had immediately, what does this mean? I mean, how many steps away are we then from seeing actual wind turbines in the ocean?
Yeah, we are several steps away.
Okay,
it's a great question. This is the very first step in a lengthy sort of federal flowchart.
Step one.
Of where we go from here to actual possible, not even guaranteed, turbine development off the seacoast. So this is just the first step in even considering whether it's possible.
Okay.
Basically, turbines offshore have to be developed in federal waters because they have to be that far out. And so this is the federal government getting the green light from the state to work with the state government on exploration and potential leasing to energy companies in waters that are directly off of New Hampshire's shores. So they have to work with each state that's like directly adjacent to those federal waters.
And
get stakeholder input, because also, you know, the energy would be essentially landed here. It would require infrastructure here. Construction would have to go on the seacoast to build these turbines off our shores. As we're seeing in Massachusetts and Rhode Island, they built a whole new essentially factory in New Bedford to build the turbines down there. And so they want input from, you know, fishermen and local governments and the state. And so this is the state setting up a task force where there will be representation from all of those groups that the state has input in, kind of who gets a seat at the table to work with the federal government, kind of keep an eye on the process as it begins to move forward over the next many years.
So it sounds like, despite the fact that it's just a small first step, this is pretty noteworthy.
Oh, it's big. Yeah. Advocates have wanted this for years. They first asked then Governor Maggie Hassan to take this task force step in 2015. And they've been asking Governor Sununu since before he took office. I mean, it was on the campaign trail, and they've really kept up a lot of pressure on him to do it. And he has now finally taken this step. And also, you know, we're seeing some interest, I think, in his administration in wind as an industrial opportunity. You know, even if we don't have turbines sited directly off the seacoast, it's sort of not if but when that there will be turbines off of the coast of Massachusetts and likely in the Gulf of Maine. In their new governor Janet Mills' administration, she signaled that she's interested in having that state return to looking at offshore wind, which they had a moratorium on for a long time under then Governor Paul LePage. So there will be turbines probably near us within the next several years. And people like our Business and Economic Development Commissioner Taylor Caswell see that as, you know, a potential industrial development opportunity. We could have factories that build turbine blades here and that kind of thing. Here's what he said on The Exchange earlier this week.
There's opportunities in the clean tech sector to do the manufacturing, to create jobs around not just, you know, generating electricity, but about building wind turbines, about building different components for those very, you know, increasingly in need components of an energy generation system that very well could be right off of our shores. So the clean tech sector broadly is one that I want to see a lot more investment in, a lot more companies here.
And so Taylor Caswell actually kind of gave his blessing to a trip that some lobbyists and advocates took to Denmark last fall, where they were directly courting wind industry players who might want to expand to places like Pease Trade Port and the port of Portsmouth there, where there's a deepwater port, there's tons of logistics connections. And even if, you know, as the process of potentially siting wind off our shore develops, you know, I think those advocates are saying, and it sounds like Commissioner Caswell may agree, that we don't have to wait to kind of capitalize on that growing industry.
So, yeah, so it sounds like there are other opportunities. But I'm curious to know, like, how feasible is offshore wind here? Like, do we even have enough wind for starters? You know, or what other infrastructure? You mentioned earlier that there's a lot of infrastructure needed to do something like this. So, yes, there's all these other opportunities, but could we even pull off the actual wind part of the thing?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the Gulf of Maine is broadly considered to be a world-class wind resource.
Oh.
I mean, the way the wind works here, the way the coastline is sort of situated, there is great potential for wind in general. New Hampshire is tricky. We have a tiny coastline. The Isle of Shoals are there off of Portsmouth, which are kind of like exactly where you might need to put turbines.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd need to put them a little further out in that case, which means they might need to be floating turbines instead of fixed turbines, which is... That technology exists, but it's sort of fancy.
Yeah, I was going to say that seems pretty intense.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, these things are huge. So even just, you know, even if it's all systems go to build them, it's a huge task. And also building the power infrastructure to get the power back to shore and distributed into the grid is something the grid is not set up to do right now. So you would have to set all of that up. You know, these are big, big companies. Shell is involved in wind development now. And big companies, Statoil, you know, who are buying up leasing areas off of Massachusetts to build wind. So this is a major industrial development if and when it happens. And it's definitely not going to happen overnight. But I do think there's potential in the Gulf of Maine and potential off New Hampshire. And that's something the federal government will look at as part of this process that's now going to begin.
So it sounds like big developments in drinking water, big, seemingly small, but actually big in offshore wind. And so now we're in the legislative session. Are there other things that Annie Ropeek's got her eye on as far as renewable energy or any legislation that you're walking? What are you tracking right now?
Yeah, there's going to be more debate about drinking water in the legislature this year, just other ways to maybe recoup money for treatment and testing and for health problems from maybe the polluters. There is talk about how to do that. On both sides of the aisle, there are bills from Democrats and Republicans on more groundwater cleanup in places like Merrimack and Portsmouth, which have seen big PFAS contamination problems. And then on renewable energy, the Democrats have laid out a pretty aggressive strategy. They would love to see New Hampshire go 100% renewable powered within the next several decades.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Governor Sununu has sort of stuck to his all of the above energy strategy. And he has been somewhat lukewarm on certain renewables in the past, especially solar power. So we'll have to see if Democrats are pushing bills that would really broadly expand that kind of development, how those fare at the governor's desk. Net metering, which is the practice of building solar, say, on your house and then kind of getting a credit on your bill for mm-hmm. the power you're putting back into the grid. That's something that was supposed to be expanded last year for big customers like towns and businesses. And the governor vetoed that bill, and they just narrowly didn't overturn that veto. So like half a dozen people have already said that they're going to propose bills on net metering this session. So we're looking at that. Biomass is also still controversial. We did see that veto overturned, that subsidy extended last year. That's awaiting a federal judgment at this time, and there will likely be bills that deal with that issue as well.
You mentioned briefly, and this was going to be my last question, about the political situation at the state house. I mean, how will the Democratic majority in both houses, you think, influence the way some of this debate happens?
I think that they have a big opportunity here to try to achieve a lot of the stuff they've wanted to do for a long time. And mm-hmm. I think they have to be strategic about it. I mean, if they throw everything at Governor Sununu just to see what sticks, I don't think they're going to have a lot of success. So I think they have to be strategic and make deals with the governor's people on what kind of renewable energy policies are actually palatable to him and to his, you know, to everyone in the state, right?
Yeah.
He hasn't said he doesn't support renewable energy. He's just a little more cautious about how we do it than I think some of the Democrats are. So it'll be interesting to hear kind of what those committee hearings are like on some of those bills. And they have all these little moving parts of how they want to achieve their 100% renewable strategy, a lot of which fly in the face of the governor's energy strategy. And,
right.
You know, I think we could see some veto fights, but hopefully they'll be trying to reach some consensus before they get to that point.
He has said on this program that in general, he wasn't going to like take a new legislative tack now that there's this Democratic majority. He's going to still be the same Governor Sununu that we saw last time. So we'll see how all this shakes out.
Yeah, no, it's going to be a spicy session, I think.
Oh, a spicy session. Annie Ropey, bring in the heat. Annie, thank you so much for coming on. It's always great to chat with you. My desk neighbor.
Thanks for having me, Lauren.
Anytime. Still to come, we are moving on to the political news of the week. Mark your calendars for more visits from 2020 presidential hopefuls. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Are you curious about Senator Elizabeth Warren's visit, or do you maybe not care about the 2020 race yet? Those people are also out there. The number again, 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Or, of course, you can post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. We're on Instagram, too, by the way. This is New Hampshire's weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Lauren Chulgen, filling in for Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Every convention about how true crime stories usually unfold is upended.
That's why Bear Brook, the latest podcast from NHPR, has been downloaded more than a million times.
30 years ago this month, a mystery began.
It's the story of a decades-old cold case that's changing how murders will be investigated forever, reported by NHPR's own Jason Moon.
This story is not going to go the way you think it is.
Download it now or check it out at bearbrookpodcast.com.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Lauren Chulgen, filling in for Peter Biello on this chilly Friday. We're going to dig into the week that was in political news now, from the president's first speech to the nation from the Oval Office to Elizabeth Warren's upcoming visit to New Hampshire tomorrow. And our guests in studio this morning are Trent Spinner, executive editor for the Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar at the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University. Good morning, both of you.
Good morning.
Hey, Lauren.
How's it going?
Good.
Well, good. We also want listeners to join us as well. Do you think President Trump should declare a national emergency to fund the border wall? Are you curious about Senator Warren's visit to New Hampshire or not ready for 2020 just yet? Either way, we want to hear from you. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Give us a call to talk about the government shutdown, 2020. You can also email us, exchange@nhpr.org. All right, Dean, Trent, let's begin the big story of the week, of course, the continuing government shutdown. Today marks the day we've been long hearing about, the day when 800,000 federal workers are going to miss their actual paycheck because of the battle going on in Washington. The president, as we heard at the top of the show, was at the border yesterday. And meanwhile, some Senate Republicans did try and hash out a deal that would reopen the government while Congress worked toward a broader agreement over border security. But then, as I read in the New York Times this morning, that deal fell apart before it even really got started because the president, as we all know, has no interest in backing such a deal. And so, Dean, let's start with you here. As we heard on the exchange yesterday, I mean, there are a lot of federal workers in New Hampshire caught in the middle of all this. So I'm curious to hear your take. I mean, how long do you think this is going to go on for?
It's a great question. We are on the verge of breaking the record of 21 days set by Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich in 1995, their famous shutdown standoff. So that may happen tomorrow. There's some suggestion that President Trump is preparing to declare an emergency and take existing funds, disaster relief funds, targeted for other kinds of disaster cleanup and repair, and allocate some of that money for the Army Corps of Engineers to start building a wall. Mm-hmm. If he does that, it'll be challenged in the courts almost immediately. Some people believe that if nothing else, it'll offer a pretext for reopening government. As you mentioned, there was an attempt by some members of Congress, particularly in the Senate, to come up with some sort of deal. But we saw yesterday Lindsey Graham, who has been at the Republican senator from South Carolina, who's been at the center of a lot of these negotiations, basically come out and say that the president should, the Democrats don't want to cooperate, the president should go ahead and declare a national emergency. So, you know, he's now weighing in a way that leads me to believe that it's not likely that there'll be some sort of an agreement. And finally, you know, not surprisingly, we've seen our Democratic congressional delegation all come out against it. Gene Shaheen has called the shutdown cruel and unnecessary. Chris Pappas also highlighted the impact on government workers, and he's holding a special shutdown town hall meeting in Exeter this weekend. And Annie Custer said should really open government and then negotiate border security separately. Now, you know, all Democrats, not surprising, but we really seem to be at a pretty significant standoff. For whatever variety of reasons, President Trump has decided to really stake, in some sense, his electoral future on this particular moment.
So you said a lot there, and there's a lot to dig into. So first, I want to start with the court challenge. I mean, a big question that I've had is, all right, so he calls the emergency declaration and he goes forward with the wall. I mean, did they start purchasing construction materials and then it goes through the court system? Does they have to wait till, how does this pan out? Do either of you know?
Well, it would go to the courts immediately. Whether there's any time to actually put this in motion, I'm not sure. This goes back to an emergency law that was signed by, I believe, President Ford in the mid-70s. And there's some debate over, given the wording of the statute, whether or not this particular circumstance on the border would qualify as a national emergency under that statute. And that's what would be challenged in court. Traditionally, presidents have pretty broad latitude in terms of emergency powers. Mm-hmm. But given the particular statute he would be using to declare executive power to do so, there'll be debate over whether or not this classifies, whether things start to gear up, or, you know, we've seen courts act pretty quickly to put stays on executive decisions. I'm not entirely sure of the timing, but this would all happen very rapidly. And members of Congress, I think, would have standing to file a lawsuit immediately.
Well, and you mentioned the president's electoral future. I mean, Trent, I saw the Union Leader has a poll on its website that asks readers if Trump should let go of the border wall and just open the government. And when I checked it last, no was winning. That most people said that he should really maintain his position. So can you give us a sense of like what the appetite for this fight here is in New Hampshire?
That's a good question. And we have heard from a lot of people who are interested in the wall. They see the wall as they see the opioid epidemic in New Hampshire partly response. They think that this, you know, migration, that drugs are coming across the border, and that the wall will help fix the opioid epidemic. And that is something that President Trump has said. He said that here in New Hampshire, and I think people have taken that to heart. I think if you ask experts about whether or not that is the case, they will disagree with that.
Right. Saying that it's the open access points where drugs are coming through.
Saying
as well.
That
right.
it's, yes, there are many other access points, including legal access points, mm-hmm. where the opioids are coming, illegal opioids are coming through. It's prescription drug abuse. I mean, there are various topics, various reasons why we're in this crisis, and building a wall itself is not going to fix the opioid crisis.
And as we know, politics moves at light speed nowadays, and you know, there's some to kind of balance that out. There's some national polling that suggests that both sides are taking a hit. President Trump a little more so. But should this be resolved, and should the government be opened up? A couple months from now, we're going to be on to something new. But if this drags on for a significant period of time, then it may have lasting effects. But this stuff tends to move very quickly.
Here's the other thing we're hearing from people, which is the government is shut down. Keep it shut down.
Really?
We're hearing that from people who don't see how it's directly affecting their life, which I can understand, right? If you don't do a number of things that are affected by the government shutdown, the partial government shutdown, I can see how you can make that argument that this has no effect on my life. The president, if you agree with the president that this wall needs to be built and there's no effect on your life, you can say, I can see what these people are saying is keep it shut down. It's not impacting me, and keep it shut down as long as you need. So there is still support for it in New Hampshire.
I mean, until you potentially eat some broccoli that like wasn't checked out by the FDA,
right.
That's...
Or take a vacation at a national park and the facilities are overflowing.
Right. I mean, that's the interesting thing about this is it feels in the now for some people, like you say, that it doesn't affect them. But it's really the after effects, right? The next week and the next month and the next year that I think are really going to be interesting to watch. And you mentioned, Dean, a little bit about our congressional delegation.
Sure.
And of course, all four Democrats
are...
Yeah,
it's not a surprise.
Not a surprise. But I wonder, could you give us a sense of how much sway or influence or power they have? I mean, when the Democrats who come out of these meetings with the president are not Gene Shaheen, it's Dick Durbin and Nancy Pelosi. And so I wonder...
Yeah, the issue is that the House is, because the Democrats now have the majority in the House, they can do things like vote pieces of legislation out or attempt to pass independent appropriations bills, individual ones, and then use that as a means of kind of opening up the government. But the roadblock really is the Senate. Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader, Republican, has said that until there's a deal, he's not really going to bring anything up for a vote. So if anything is really going to change, and if it doesn't come from President Trump, at a minimum, it's going to have to involve it would involve our senators, Hassan and Shaheen, more likely than the members of the House, because that's where the real logjam is right now. Other than obviously President Trump's position, legislatively speaking, the issue was with McConnell and the Senate.
Yeah. Well, yesterday, newly elected Congressman Chris Pappas tried to give, his voice into this fight. He gave his first speech on the U.S. House floor about the shutdown. So let's take a listen to a little bit of that.
I'm here on behalf of a furloughed IRS worker from Sandown. Her bank is denying her the interest-free loan they promised federal workers because the furlough letter the IRS gave her was too vague. And of course, there's no one around at the IRS to write her a new one. I'm here on behalf of an air traffic controller from Derry who just transferred airports and has been told she may not get the back pay because she was furloughed prior to starting her new assignment. And I'm here on behalf of an FAA worker from Hampton who's being forced to take unpaid leave to look after his wife, who's going through a health emergency. He's worrying about how he can possibly care for his spouse without knowing when his next paycheck is going to arrive. These workers from my district deserve better from our nation's leaders.
So, despite the fact that maybe Chris Pappas is not at the White House having these conversations, they're all trying to, it seems, throw their voice into this fight as much as possible.
Sure. There are about 2,400 people who aren't getting a paycheck today in New Hampshire, mm-hmm. who are federal workers. Just to add to the list of people that Congressman Pappas was talking about, we talked to a FEMA person from Hooksett who was just in Puerto Rico for 60 days, usually would use this paycheck in his cash flow situation to pay for his two car payments for him and his wife and groceries, utilities, that kind of thing, but will not be receiving that paycheck. He borrowed his daughter's money, Christmas money, to make some of those payments and to buy groceries and buy gas. So there are a lot of stories out there. And the question is, how many people are paying attention to the plight of these 2,400 people? How much political pressure will these 2,400 people push on the Trump administration?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are stories like that all across the country.
Well, let's turn to everyone's favorite topic, the New Hampshire primary. Someone definitely rolled their eyes in their car just now. Neither of you did, though. You were like, yeah, exactly. No, no problem with that. So let's start with Senator Elizabeth Warren. She made her big announcement last week that she's thinking about running for president. That feels like it was years ago already, but that was just last week, believe it or not. And her first campaign stop naturally was Iowa. So let's listen to a little bit of what she said while she was in Iowa for her first campaign-ish stop.
I have spent my entire career on one central question: what's happening to working families? Why is America's middle class getting hollowed out? And it's because Washington works great for the rich and the powerful. It's just not working for anyone else. That's why I'm in this fight, and that's what I'm going to talk about every single day.
So, Dean, let's start with you. I mean, she says that's what she'll be talking about every single day. I mean, she's coming to Manchester and Concord tomorrow. You know, do we expect to hear more of that from her? What else do we hear? What else do we think she's going to be talking to New Hampshire voters about?
Yeah, you have to keep in mind that when Elizabeth Warren first burst onto the scene, she was really as a consumer financial advocate. She used to appear on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart periodically, and she would get great reviews, and that eventually led her to move into running for political office. And so that she has always been very tightly focused on economic inequality, corporate greed, economic injustice. So I think you're going to hear a lot of that message for her going forward. And the interesting thing for me as a political scientist is the way in which she has jump-started the 2020 cycle. Her announcement really has accelerated consideration by a number of other candidates.
And how it was so?
It's basically people are moving up their announcements into January. They were going to see an acceleration of visits to the state in January. If you remember back to the 2016 primary on the Republican side, and even 2012, I recall, it took a little bit longer for the fields to fill in more in kind of the February through April or May time period. And I think that's accelerating dramatically because she has gotten, you know, other candidates are seeing, you know, how much attention she's getting. As you mentioned, when she announced, the cable networks were giddy. They were so tired of talking about what's going on in Washington that they would literally spend half their shows talking about Warren announcing. And so to get that kind of free media coverage and attention for her has been great as a candidate. And I think others want to piggyback on that. And it's really an opportunity for her to reintroduce herself. You know, the conventional wisdom has been that over the last several years, her stock as a potential presidential candidate has dropped a bit for a variety of reasons. But this for her has been an opportunity to reintroduce herself. And so far, the energy surrounding her candidacy has been quite good.
And that's, you know, nationally. I mean, do either of you have a sense what her support is like among Democrats here?
Well, to Dean's point about New Hampshire, just going back, we're about to start. We are starting right now, probably a year-long Democratic primary. And that is... It's going to be big. I mean,
buckle up, Trent.
Buckle up.
We used to call it the invisible primary. It's not so invisible anymore.
That's true. That is
right?
That was a big
right. Not with technology and social media anymore.
So it's starting right now. It's going to go for potentially a year or not a little bit more. And in terms of her political support, I think that there is a lot. It's unclear because I think most Democrats don't know, right? Most Democrats who we've talked to have said, hey, we still want to meet all the candidates. We want to meet them once, twice, three times before
we
decide.
Shake their hand every time.
Shake their hand every time. Have them come to our living room. So I think there's still question about whether or not there's political support, but there is certainly name recognition, right? As the senator from a next door state, there's a lot of name recognition. And remember what happened with Bernie Sanders, right? He won by 23 points in New Hampshire, and the Clinton campaign at the time really tried to pitch it as he's New England's favorite son. I remember that saying, even though no one in New Hampshire really knew Bernie Sanders before he ran. People in New Hampshire know who Elizabeth Warren is, so there are going to be high expectations for her. Don't forget, the last three Democrats from Massachusetts who ran in primaries in New Hampshire, they all won. John Kerry in 2004, Paul Tsongas in 1992, and Dukakis in 88. So there's a lot of expectations. She also has a ton of money in the bank.
Yeah.
She's got more than $10 million, more than any other senator who could potentially run, because she has a lot of money left over from her last Senate campaign that she won. So there's a lot of money in the bank. There's a lot of name recognition. It's unclear how much political support there will be, and that's kind of what the primary is all about.
Well, and the interesting thing is, I think it's fair to say that the Democratic Party has shifted to the left a bit over the last couple of presidential cycles. And in the last time around, Bernie Sanders had a fairly monolithic lock on the progressive wing of the party. That's not going to be the case this time. There are going to be multiple players in that ideological space in the Democratic Party. And so it's going to be interesting to see, if he decides to run, what kind of internecine warfare there's going to be within the progressive wing. Between at least these two, and then you can mix in a number of other possible progressive candidates as well.
The other thing I think is interesting about this visit, it actually starts with a private event today. So the public is not welcome to attend that, which I think is an interesting way to start, to have your first visit.
Well, and
in
one
New
of
Hampshire.
Them tomorrow is pooled press. So it's not like one of them is public tomorrow. The other one is very, there will only be a handful of reporters.
Right. And so I just think it's a very interesting way to start the your primary campaign in New Hampshire. It reminds me so much of the listening tour that Hillary Clinton did when she started, which was Hillary Clinton sitting at the head of a round table and not saying anything, just listening to people, not taking any questions from the media, not really taking any questions from the public. And that went for several weeks, and it, I think it really hurt her.
And can I ask too, so Elizabeth Warren will be coming back then in February for this big dinner that the
right.
New Hampshire Democratic Party has.
Jean, yep.
Right. I mean, I wondered if this was kind of a bummer for other Democratic potential hopefuls. I mean, that's a pretty high profile, or is it? I mean, give people a sense. I mean, it's seemingly a big high-profile speaking
spot.
Yeah,
it's always nice to get the nod for one of these party dinners or fundraisers. But, it's not going to deter a number of other candidates. Just off the top of my head, coming in the next few weeks, we have Jay Inslee, a governor of Washington, Julian Castro, the former Health and Human Services Secretary for Barack Obama is going to come. Eric Swalwell, the
California.
Youngish congressman from California. I think he's 38 or 39. He's been very visible, and he's coming as well, and there are going to be others on top of that.
So before we head into the break, I'm curious to hear from both of you, since you've been watching primaries for a long time. I mean, is there anything from history that we can draw from here of another primary? I'm thinking like 1976, where there wasn't a front runner and a bunch of Democrats jumped in, or is just the political history is so different now than it was now? I mean, can we learn anything from past primaries about big primaries like this?
Yeah, well, I think that the environment in which these, I think in some sense, there's some continuity between the modern primary and caucus system that we have really traces back to the early 1970s and some reforms that the party made to increase participation by voters and give more potential candidates an opportunity to run for president. So I think there is some continuity in that respect, but the nature of the environment, the amount of money, the way that technology and social media has kind of renationalized organization. I mean, for me, the biggest difference is that now, instead of New Hampshire being this kind of regional primary where candidates come with little fanfare and kind of build their candidacies and gain momentum, it's now national, international immediately because of social media, because of all the money involved. And it brings a lot more outside influence into the state. And I think, that's very different than, say, the 1970s with Jimmy Carter campaigning up here, or even Bill Clinton when he was the comeback kid in 1992. So I think there's some similarities, but it'll shake out. We'll have some big cattle call debates starting probably next summer or fall, where there are going to be multiple tiers of people, but you'll see people drop out, I think, pretty quickly at some point.
Well, like Trent says, buckle up. We're in for it already.
Absolutely.
Coming up, we're going to talk about some questions around Governor Sununu's inauguration celebrations and who does and who should be paying for them. Also, Breida Green's going to come in. She's going to talk about the state's launch of the new addiction treatment plan, The Doorway. Did you attend any of the public forums this week? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You're listening to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Lauren Chulgen. We'll be right back.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Lauren Chulgin, filling in for Peter Biello. I'm here in studio with union leader editor Trent Spinner and Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University. And joining us to end the hour is NHPR's Brita Green, who covers the Upper Valley. Hey, Brita.
Hey, Lauren.
So before we turn to some Brita specialties, let's have a moment for this ongoing situation about Governor Sununu's inauguration celebrations and who should be paying for them. Trent, I want to turn this one over to you. Can you give us a little background on this story and where we are now?
Okay. So as background, Union Leader reporter Todd Feathers took the time to dig into who paid for Governor Sununu's first inaugural. So what governors are allowed to do under state law is create a 501c4, which is a nonprofit, but it's not the type of nonprofit that you might think of, you know, as a soup kitchen or a homeless shelter. It's a political nonprofit. Received more than $450,000 from corporate lobbyists, corporations, lobbyists, you know, big donors. So Todd then took a look at how that money was spent. About $50,000 went to Blue Orchid Interiors, which is owned by the governor's sister. Paul Collins, who is the governor's senior advisor, received about $48,000. The governor himself received multiple payments for what they called expenses and traveling, totaling more than $39,000. The governor's office said all of this is legal. They had to disclose this under a new state law that mandated it. This had not existed in the past. Governor Lynch had released this information voluntarily. Governor Hassan never did. So we filed a request to the governor's office, a right to know request, and I think various other parties did, including the Democratic Party, filed a request to just find out more about these expenses. How did this travel work? Where did he go? And the governor's office declined to release that information. They said that information would reflect what they said, enough of a pattern that would give somebody an idea about what the governor was likely to do in the future. So they wouldn't want to release that because it could potentially be a security issue. And so they say that they have executive privilege. They don't need to release. We filed a right to know request. They don't need to release this information. I think we're looking at other options and how we get that information.
And so what's the there here? Why is it important for the public to know how this thing was paid for and what this group is like?
Well, the governor received money. This 501c4 that went to support the governor's inaugural fund received money from people who have business in front of the state. Eversource gave $25,000. The company that manages some medical contracts for the state gave $25,000. So what has happened is that money went into the inaugural fund. The governor's senior advisors, family members, and the governor himself have used that money for various expenses. And so our question is, what were those expenses? And we think that the public has a right to know about where that money's going.
Yeah. Do you buy this security argument?
I don't know. Without being able to see the information, it's very difficult to tell. Yes, if they are if they're booking certain things or flights or hotels or what, but without being able to see it, it's hard to know.
So where does this go from here?
Well, I think the governor's office is pretty clear. They're not going to be releasing this information. They say they have executive privilege. They don't need to release it. So somebody could file a lawsuit challenging that. Or legislators are looking at potentially changing the law again to mandate that these expenses are detailed in these reports.
Well, we'll keep an eye on that one. And speaking of other state news, Brita's here because she's been covering this rollout of the Doorway New Hampshire, which is a thing that, you know, we've all been paying attention to. It's the new addiction treatment system. The state has been launching this week with public forums. So can you just give us a reminder of, you know, what the program looks like and how the state got to this point, Brita?
Yeah, so this is the state's sort of first attempt at making a really comprehensive statewide system to address opioid addiction. Up until this point, it really, your sort of access to care and treatment depended on where you lived. So if you were in a place like Manchester, you might have more access to a safe station where you could get immediate help. But if you were in the North Country, who knows where your closest provider would be. So they got a big amount of federal money last year, and they're using that to create what they're calling a hub and spoke system that they're naming the Doorway, where in 9 regions of the state, there's a central hub where you can go for services and then from there get evaluated for what you might need and referred to local providers for help.
Okay, so in these nine areas, there were public forums this week, and feel free to jump in, guys, if you want to. What have those meetings been like? I mean, who's showing up for them, and what have they been talking about there?
Yeah, it's been really interesting. So I went to two of them. I went to one in Concord and one in Lebanon. The one in Concord was enormously popular. I think it took officials by surprise. Actually, it was in a conference room in Concord Hospital that was overflowing. Like, people were spilling out into the hallways to try to hear what was going on. I think that basically there's a lot of optimism around this system that it's going to make it easier for people to get help. But there's also a lot of uncertainty and a lot of questions. Like, the basic framework is in place as of January 1. You can go to one of these locations. You can call 211 at any time to get help. But there's, like, all kinds of questions still circulating out there. So
yeah, that was one of my big questions for all of you. I mean, do we feel like we're now in a place as a state where we're really going to get a handle on this crisis and that this is really going to launch us off?
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that. I was just thinking as I was listening to Brita that, you know, we've been covering this opioid crisis on the Roundup now for at least 3 or 4 years. It's been a regular topic of discussion. And where we are now, just in terms of how the problem is conceptualized, when we first started talking about this 3-4 years ago, the question was, well, is it a law enforcement issue or is it a health care issue? Mm-hmm. And now the state has really moved towards this idea that it's a addiction problem, it's a misuse problem, and that it can be treated as an enhanced health care issue. And so to see this hub and spoke model in place now, given where we were just 3 or 4 years ago, is pretty remarkable. I mean, the number of deaths and overdoses is still too high. I mean, I think in comparison to other states, we're a little bit ahead of the game now because we were one of the earliest to have a serious problem. But yeah, absolutely. I think that there. You know, I don't know. We'll see in practice how this works, but it's a remarkable improvement from where we were 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, Trent, where are we now, you think?
Well, so the hub and spoke system is just starting in New Hampshire, but it isn't starting. It's not new to the country. Vermont actually put this in place several years ago. And we have a reporter, Union Leader reporter Sean Wickham, has been spending the last year looking at solutions that are really working on the opioid epidemic. And she actually went to Vermont a few months ago to talk to them about how their hub and spoke system is working. She found an incredible story there, that no one waits for a bed in Vermont. Their hub and spoke system, which has been up and running for a long time, has gotten to the point where if you're in crisis, doesn't matter what time of day or night, the services are available to you. And they have been able to get people into those hubs, and the hubs kind of determine which spokes you need. So before Sean went to Vermont and really detailed, I was even confused about how this works, but that's how it works. So if you're in crisis or you need help, you go to this hub. The providers at the hub determine which parts of the spoke. So maybe you need ongoing treatment. That's a spoke. Maybe you need transportation. Maybe you need help finding a job. They're all different types of spokes that feed into this hub. And so the hub decides, okay, you need these different spokes. Here's where they are. Here's how you get connected. And here's how we get you help. And so that way people aren't trying to find space, trying to find a bed in crisis, because people who are dealing with a crisis have already been helped and are moving through the system.
Yeah, I think the important thing in New Hampshire here is that we're still figuring out exactly how this is going to work. So yeah, I mean, what he just outlined is the system. But at these public info sessions this week, we've been hearing the people who would, in theory, be providing that transportation, be providing that treatment, showing up and being like, hey, do you even know I exist? You know, how am I going to get paid? Those kind of fundamental questions. Mm-hmm. So we do have to see sort of what's going to happen here.
So it sounds like it's starting to lift off. There's still a lot of open questions, but cautiously optimistic, you three sound,
sure,
about that.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually a big comprehensive
compared
system
to 3 or 4 years
place.
Ago, sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then last night there was an executive order kind of joining in on this. This, to your point, Dean, about how the state is now looking at this as a mental health or a health problem.
Right.
The governor, he signed an executive order that is having this new advisory council look at opioid prescribing and misuse patterns. And so I didn't know if you guys had any thoughts on that and going that route. Brita, go ahead.
Yeah, I think this will be interesting. So what they're going to do is try to look at insurance claims to see if they can identify trends in providers or geographic areas or things along those lines to see sort of where over-prescribing has become a problem or any other trends they can identify along those lines. And I think in theory, this is federally funded. If it works here, they can sort of apply it in different states. So it'll be an experiment to see
Well, hopefully it will all work out well, and we'll see the overdose number go down, obviously. So also while we've got Brita here, two other stories she's been covering. First, Dartmouth, if you want to give us an update on, obviously, you know, they're trying to celebrate their 250th anniversary up there, but there's so many other headlines that they're dealing with. Give us a snapshot of what they've been dealing with lately.
Right. So this has been an ongoing story now for over a year, I think. Sexual misconduct claims coming out of their psychological and brain sciences department. What we've been seeing since a big federal lawsuit was filed in November November is a lot of response coming from the campus community, like faculty, staff, but also alumni. So mm-hmm. there's been a group of alumni forming and really pressing the administration for a stronger response to this. And the administration did announce a new initiative. They're calling it the Campus Climate and Culture Initiative, or C3I, that's attempting to put more resources towards diversity, towards prevention, and change some things to kind of prevent these things from happening in the
and
future.
And that's been received well? I mean, one of the big questions, I think, does this kind of big coverage about this really difficult issue have any impact on their brand or on how alumni, potential students, and current students feel about the institution?
That's the big question. I mean, I think when you see them coming out and announcing a big new initiative, that shows that they're concerned about that reputation. What I've been hearing in response is sort of skepticism, maybe cautious optimism, but there's a lot of details still to be worked out about what this actually means in practice.
All right. And since before we let you go, Brita, tell us, you are the originator in our newsroom of the fucking great story. Please let us know. This was a big topic on the show last week, was it not, Dean? So what's the
yes,
latest?
The latest is, so this story really actually first came out before the holidays, but went viral, I would say, this week. It was all
it was
over
like
the national
in Fox News. It
yeah.
was, yeah, it was everywhere.
Yeah. My understanding is it was on a prep service for DJs. So like, you know, top 40 stations or whatever we're talking about it. So
oh my God.
the restaurant is actually selling these t-shirts online that have completely sold out. They say they're shipping out hundreds of these t-shirts
what?
A day. And now what's interesting is locally in Keene. Of course, if you follow Keene over the years, you know that there's this isn't the first time they've been in the national news for sort of an offbeat story. And there's some questions circling about what connections this might have to the Free Keene movement or some of the former or current Free Staters in the area.
So. All right. Keep us posted, Brita. Man, she's on. What a diverse beat of stories you've got going on. And before I let you two go, is there anything, let's mix it up, I mean, besides what you're watching for next week, this weekend, whatever, any stories that came to mind that you feel really compelled to share, Trent?
One story that was in the Sunday News that has now been read by more than 200,000 people was written by Ty Gagne, a freelancer for us. It's called Footprints in the Snow. It was an emotional rescue that will really surprise you if you take the time to read it. 200,000 people have read it, and I honestly have never heard more positive feedback about a story since then. It's on our website, unionleader.com.
I read it. I will also say it's worth a read. And what are you looking at, Dean?
I will say, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, if anybody in New Hampshire wanted to follow what was going on in Iowa in terms of the presidential caucus, you had to wait for it to show up in the New York Times or the Washington Post a day or two later.
Mm-hmm.
Now I find myself increasingly on social media. There's great reporting and commentary on Iowa from Iowa journalists, and you can read it in real time, and that's been a lot of fun. The social media, Twitter, has really opened up that opportunity for me.
I do love dispatches from Iowa. Thanks, guys, for coming on the show today. That's Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, Union Leader, Executive Editor Trent Spinner, and of course, NHPR's Brita Green and Annie Ropeek. Thanks so much to all of you for coming on. That's it for today. The conversation, though, of course, continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Producers Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Lauren Chulgen. Peter Biello is going to be back in the chair next Friday. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.